Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. The COVID-19 pandemic has created many challenges at home and abroad. To help untangle the plethora of messages we're receiving, journalist Sean Tubbs started The Quarantine Report, a brand new podcast series that focuses on the pandemic both locally and statewide. Sean Tubbs is a Charlottesville journalist and podcaster whose professional career has spanned two decades. He is the founder of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network and has spent over a decade writing for Charlottesville Tomorrow and The Daily Progress. Sean is also the host of The Quarantine Report, heard Sundays at 10 a.m. right here on 94.7 WPVC. I spoke with Sean earlier this week from his home studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Dan.
You're the founder of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. That site has been around for 15 years now. Talk about how you came to start that site.
Sure. Well, that goes back to a time when I was working as a freelance radio producer for public radio locally. And from the time that I started doing that in 1995 or thereabouts and 2005, the amount of available real estate on their airwaves was becoming more and more limited. And as a radio producer, you gather a lot more sound than you actually put on the radio generally. Now, a lot of that is just because the attention span of the average listener, you know, doesn't necessarily want to do a deep dive into stuff. But me as the reporter, I'm fascinated by all of this stuff. So with podcasting, it was a way for me to experiment, one, with just a place to put the work that I was doing. But the other thing, it was really a place where I could sort of do some experiments with what the different with a medium that I've grown up with. I've been making strange sounds on computers for a very long time, and you know, have always been fascinated by it. So the podcasting network, you know, was there for several years. We did a lot of innovation. You were part of that in a lot of ways, and the idea though was, I've always wanted to be able to use this medium to tell stories, and that's kind of why we're here today.
Talk a little bit about your work at Charlottesville Tomorrow and the Daily Progress.
Sure. Well, so sometime in 2007, you know, and this is kind of what we were talking about with the innovation. One of the things that Charlottesville Tomorrow was created for was to do election coverage. And in 2005, when I started, both they and the Free Enterprise Forum had the idea to record the candidate forums for all the local offices. So that was a place where I was able to, I was hired by both organizations at different times. And then I got to work for Charlottesville Tomorrow beginning in 2007 and sort of went off in a different direction, learning a lot about how this community really works in terms of how the sausage gets made, you know, the nuts and bolts of how, you see an idea turn from an application into construction. Charlottesville Tomorrow was formed to sort of educate people about how land use politics works and all of these various things. And in 2009, we entered into a partnership with the Daily Progress, where our stories went into the Progress for free. It was a nonprofit exchange because the quality of the work was seen to be pretty good. And for almost 10 years, I wrote a lot of stories.
and during this time, is this during the time when you really got an understanding of how zoning bylaws and municipal or local governments worked, or did you come to your time with Charlottesville Tomorrow already knowing that stuff?
It was sort of stuff I had kind of known about. Obviously, I had done some podcasts about some small things here and there in the community. I used to live in the Fry Spring neighborhood, for instance, and I had a podcast once where it wasn't edited. It was just bringing people the raw stuff. But it was this long conversation about this one piece of infrastructure, this thumb that the city installed at the intersection of Cleveland Avenue and Cherry and Willard. And it was just a strange thing, but I realized people are passionate about this stuff, and that it really fascinates me. When I was a kid, there was a shopping center that was proposed close by to my house down in Lynchburg. And it was just amazing to see the neighborhood come together to fight this thing. But of course, then the fight goes away and there's no record of it. So writing about these things and being able to document, whether it being in a podcast or a story, is something I've always wanted to do. You know, I think it's important to write down history as we live through things, or to record it.
Your brand new podcast series is called The Quarantine Report. How did that come about?
Well, a couple of things. So there was a moment when it all seemed like this was all very serious to me. Like it was a time on, as soon as the state of emergency was declared on March 12th, I had this real sense that things were going to change and things were going to be different. And, and I hadn't been paying attention to it, and all the work that I do in my day job was sort of kind of put on hold. At my day job, which is currently with the Piedmont Environmental Council, it's going to a meetings, it's all that sort of thing. And I really haven't been writing. I really haven't been doing a lot of the podcasting work. So on the Sunday, I also help with something called Civilpedia, which is something that started at Charlottesville Tomorrow. And so on that Thursday night, March 12th, I just sat there and I just began a page just to sort of document and bring all these different things together, because I wanted to understand what we were going through. I had never covered public health on this kind of scale before. And so by the Sunday, which I guess was March 15th, this was the day that, you know, it was a very strange and somber day, because my favorite bar, Rapture, had made the decision that day to close. And, you know, I just got home and I was like, well, gosh, things are very serious. I'm going to be spending a lot of time in my house. And I just started getting to work. I heard the governor spoke that day around noon, and somehow I recorded it, which is not something I do. Up until that point, I really wasn't recording things. But I recorded, and I could just hear that, gosh, I've got to document this. You know, this is some of that local history. This is something that's really happening, and I have to do everything I can to really try to make sure I can at least capture it for myself. And here we are now. There's over 33 episodes so far.
And how long is each episode, and how often do you publish?
Well, it really depends. That first week it was daily, because things were happening so fast, and there were so many things that we'll talk about as this show continues today. There were so many things that I didn't know the first thing about. And so each day was really trying to just get a sense of, you know, like, here we are in this strange new time, and I wanted to do something about it. So each episode really depends on what's happening. It's sort of kind of, it's really now decided, because here we are 10 weeks in, and my job is now a lot more, my day job is a lot more consuming. So I haven't been publishing as many. But ideally, I'd be doing a daily. Like, ideally, I would be really trying to do a lot more to really document this. But I have to make do with the time that I have. So each episode consists generally of whatever the latest numbers are from the Virginia Department of Health, something from Governor Northam. But what I've really been trying to do is to try to add things about what nonprofits are doing, especially in places and in areas where, regardless of the pandemic or not, they're areas of concern and discussion that I feel the public should be paying more attention to. So to get back to the question there, you know, it's like I publish them as I can. But I initially tried to have them be no longer than 20 minutes, and that was a production thing. These days, I try not to have them be longer than 35 minutes. But of course, it's really just, it's sort of a hobby, but it's also more than a hobby, because I'm trying to do the best work I can right now.
Journalist Sean Tubbs with us this morning, talking about his brand new podcast series, The Quarantine Report. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. As a professional journalist, Sean, I'm wondering if you could share some advice for any of our listeners who would think they might like to start their own podcast.
Well, I would suggest at this point, you can hire me, frankly. This is something I'm actually, I'm kind of not joking. 15 years ago, there was kind of a method to my madness to sort of do, to help with this kind of medium. But in terms of that, though, I think it really comes down to the writing. It's like, what do you want to say? Like, the podcast is really just one thing, one aspect of journalism. It's also something that's really powerful. I would say a curiosity towards sound, you know, because it's one thing to talk, but there's a lot of work that goes into it. If you actually sit down and record yourself, for instance, do you say a lot? You've really got to get rid of that. You really have to have sort of some kind of a cadence that you can do. So, you know, first of all, do you have a good voice? And do you have something to say? And of course, but that's advice I would give to anybody looking to do a podcast, a blog, or even, you know, a dedicated Twitter feed.
Sure.
Have focus, I think, is the key.
So you got this idea to, and a great idea it was, to summarize the hours and hours of coverage in the state and locally on COVID and condense it down into something more edible. You chose that topic. I'm wondering, again, for someone who wants to start their own podcast, I'm wondering how do you go about finding a topic? I mean, why did this topic, the quarantine report, why did it speak to you so directly, so early on?
Well, I think in this case, you know, it's as somebody who's been writing professionally and writing about events, and seeing that we were on one certain trajectory. The economy was going really well. Things seemed to be pretty stable. Of course, stable for some. Things have never been stable for others. But of course, suddenly you have this big impact. I mean, when restaurants started closing, when there's this real sense that you have whole businesses that are kind of questionable going forward, and it's like you want to document that and you want to capture stuff. But also, as a journalist, for me, I wanted very much to make sure that people were getting good information. I mean, there's a lot to digest in each of these different things. And I think that that's just something that is, you know, is within me. It's like, I deliberately wanted to be a journalist, since my early days. So I think for that, it's like, you know, I think that it's having the ability to do the storytelling. But I think for anybody who wants it, you know, I think it's just, it comes out. I was really inspired for this. Like, I have to give a shout out definitely to a woman named Lisa Woolfork. She has I'm going to botch the name of I think the podcast is called Stitch Please. But Lisa is somebody who, she's a woman who hosts an Instagram or has an Instagram account called Black Women Stitch. And we had met with her. I was her mentor, along with a woman named Emily Kilroy. We were both mentors for Lisa, and we met in late February for our first meeting, and she wanted help with podcasting. And honestly, it was her focus and her attention that really inspired me to say, hey, I can do this too. So I think just look to other people who are doing things, and just, you know, people who want to do good work to transform the community. At least that's my interest. You know, find something good in the world and try to make it better. I guess that's where I'd go with that.
Sean, you're talking to us today from your home studio. Talk a little bit, without getting too techy, talk a little bit about your home studio and how you set it up. What kind of equipment do you have? You know, how did you get started with the hardware part of it?
I would say in this case, I'm a big fan of the movie Star Wars and the original one. And the reason is because the aesthetic is sort of ragtag, and things are sort of cobbled together from old equipment. And that's pretty much exactly what I have here. I have a microphone. I have an old shotgun mic that I used to use, which I think was a gift. Actually, we probably shouldn't talk about the origin of the shotgun microphone. But it's a high-quality microphone that still sounds pretty good. I have an old mixer from the time when I was a freelancer trying to make a go of it in this field. So I had all this old stuff, and I had all these old cables, and I had all this old equipment that was really just kind of lying around. And since then, it's like the first few episodes, I was like really trying to piece together ways to do it. And I've really like this, all these instincts kicked in, and I managed to cobble it together in such a way that it actually sounds good. I managed to purchase another computer, so that I could do it. It's really just an extension of the career I've had where, you know, as a freelance radio producer, sometimes you're wearing a blanket over your head in order to kind of mimic the sound of a studio. I'm not wearing a blanket over my head at the moment. I've kind of gotten past that, I think. But you know, at the moment, I would say that like it's just, you know, I think that you see a lot of people these days messing around with video on TikTok, on Instagram. It's because the tools are there to do it. I think there's probably good tools out there for people to learn podcasting and to do it themselves. It just really comes from just a love of audio, which is its own separate medium. If you can play around with it, like that's another thing too. I also do record a lot of music myself, and I do a lot of weird, strange sounds. So it's sort of all been there. It's just that the beginning of the pandemic was like this real impetus to just put it all together in a way that allows me to record from home and send this to you easily.
Sean, we have just a minute before our first break. Could you just touch briefly on the kind of software that you need to do this?
Sure. Well, I'm actually sort of like, again, like for me, it's a relic of just having, having a system in which I've been, I use a copy of Adobe Audition from that's 15 years old, I think. And the reason I do it is because it does exactly what it needs to do. It's a program that is based off a shareware program that I was using in the late 90s called Cool Edit that got acquired and, you know, was turned into this engine. But I use that because I've been using that for 20 years, and I have production files that date back, maybe not that long, but at least 10 to 15 years. But of course, the other thing is that since I started podcasting, there are all these off the shelf, services that you can do that all you basically have to do is provide the files and it does all the work. That's so much different from what it was, or at least from what I was trying to figure out back in the early days.
We have journalist Sean Tubbs with us this morning talking about his brand new podcast series, The Quarantine Report. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. After the break, more with journalist Sean Tubbs. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. We're back with journalist Sean Tubbs talking about his new podcast series, The Quarantine Report. And we're going to play a little clip right now from last Sunday's WPVC version of The Quarantine Report. And perhaps Sean can talk a little bit later about the difference between the two. This clip aired last Sunday on WPVC. It's 2 minutes long, and we're going to play that now. And then after we hear that, we're going to come back and talk about it. So hang in with us. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
It has now been 10 weeks since the state of emergency was declared, and there are still many more milestones to go. In the weeks to come, we're going to continue to hear all kinds of numbers, numbers which are being used by state officials to make further decisions.
This is like a novel, if you will, and every day has a chapter or two that's new, and I only wish that I knew how that last chapter would read, and I don't know that, and we don't know that, and that's why, you know, people need to be patient and continue to follow our guidelines. We look at data rather than dates, and that's what we'll continue to do as we move forward.
At the end of his press conference on Wednesday, Northam reflected on where we are. You've heard these words before, perhaps, but maybe it's good to keep playing them.
I understand we have been through very, very difficult times. Our lives have literally been turned upside down by COVID-19. I know a lot of you across our Commonwealth have made sacrifices. People have lost their jobs. As we've said, the access to health care, the testing, the PPE has been a challenge. The opioid and addiction crisis, just a lot of things are going on in Virginia right now. And I would just remind all of you that we're going to get through this together. And so an observation, and I'm sure you all have seen it, people right now are on edge. People are testy. We've seen reports, not so much in Virginia, but perhaps in other areas. One business actually shut down after they opened because people were being rude and abusive to the employees there. And that's something that we all regret. And again, understanding that we're all of us under stress, but remember the Virginia way, and I'm always talking to our legislators about this. We can all agree to disagree, but at the end of the day, we have to work together.
That short clip was from the Quarantine Report, the radio version of it, and that aired last Sunday. Sean, I could hear that Sean Tubbs cadence in there, and you were talking earlier about cadence in your voice. How did you develop that, or did it just come to you at some point?
It's practice. I mean, I think I grew up with two sources, listening to public radio and listening to that voice for years, but also to sort of listening to a lot of British similar programming and also things from the Canadian Broadcasting Company. I've always, but of course, old AM radio thing, like there's something powerful to me about the sound of a newscaster. And so being able to turn that on, you know, it's sort of interesting, but this is the first time I've ever really done a podcast, which sort of includes or any kind of audio journalism that includes me in it. So it's been interesting over these past 3 months or so to sort of get back to developing that. If you go back through the archives of the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, there's a ton of stuff out there with me in it, but it's all very little of it is personal or is different. I mean, I think that certainly it's something where I've been, you know, these strange sounds that one day the public might actually hear, I think might explain a lot about how I put things together. Because, you know, I think just those years as a freelance producer, you end up recording a lot and you end up getting good at it because that's how you get picked up. So doing this podcast, it is I'm very practiced. But also, too, in my day job, which is separate from this, you know, I now have to go to meetings and speak. So learning how to speak and to try to talk like that is something that does come over time. But gosh, I remember hating my voice, thinking I sounded stupid. But over the years, you just gain confidence, especially if you can fight whatever doubt you have inside of yourself and just begin to believe.
Now, there were two sound bites from Governor Northam in that clip we just heard, but your series is just filled with interesting sound bites. I'm wondering what the process is that you use to, well, first of all, to collect them and then to work through them and decide which ones you want to use.
Well, a lot of it is, you know, it's instinct in a lot of it. Like as a writer, you just sort of know, and like having covered a lot of government meetings over the years, you just sort of develop, and having written a lot of news stories, you just develop a sense of what the sound bites are and what's relevant and what's interesting. It's been interesting producing the version for this radio station, because I sort of have to think to a clock now. And so like the form of it matters. With a podcast, I can go as long as I want. So sometimes I think it's maybe a little bit longer, but also too, I want people to hear the information. It's, you know, the sources of most of the things, at least in the early days, were government meetings. And of course there's still quite a lot of that, but adding in interviews. You know, I've been trying to get people to come on the show to give me various bits and pieces of their life, because I want to fit it all together, because, you know, we're all going through this. In that show from last week, I think there's something from David Plunkett, who is the head of the library system, you know, where he just talks about how this is something we've all gone through, and knowing that really helps. So I think putting this all together, having the governor in, as well as balanced by, say, a woman who's just been laid off from her job. I mean, you know, I'm trying to document and just tell these stories. So it just sort of comes to me as if I was writing anything else.
Right. And I noticed that you generally use primary sources. In fact, I don't think I ever heard you use a secondary source. Is that true? It sounds like you'll get a soundbite from Governor Northam, but not a soundbite from someone talking about what Governor Northam said. Is that right?
Oh, no. Gosh, no. No, I think the only time I've done that is I wanted a clip from Governor Northam when he went on Face the Nation. That was the closest I got. Because, you know, that's the thing, is that the primary sources are so much more interesting. You know, if you look at what I get frustrated about this, and I'm still trying to figure out how to articulate this well, but I would much rather people watch things themselves and made up their own mind on what they saw. So the more I can bring people back to a primary source, be it the governor speaking, be it, let's say, a city council meeting or an obscure meeting on transportation, those are all meetings that, you know, things are happening at those. And of course, you know, a very interesting point is that those are all public record. So if it's at a public meeting, well, I'm sorry, like those meetings, for instance, and it's fair game. Whatever gets said, then it's fair game. It's the public record. There's no opportunity for, well, I didn't say that or whatever, because, well, you did.
Sure.
You know, so I think that I'm a big pusher of primary sources. And of course, the secondary sources, though, I do try to, you know, I rely on other people's reporting. I can't get to everything. So I think I definitely try to make sure that my colleagues and former, and well, they're still my colleagues, but my former partners at the Daily Progress, that they get the credit that they have for being out there every day trying to get these stories to people.
So in other words, if you can't get the primary soundbite, you're going to get it from a trusted source.
Well, I think for this show, you know, like again, if it was like, I mean, I always try to dig deep. So like, I mean, like, I can't think of an example for this show, but I research my tweets. And yesterday, this is a small aside just about journalism in general, but there was an article on a television website about the Amherst Town Council. And this is crazy. The Amherst Town Council last year, or maybe it was earlier this year, they used a provision in the charter to get rid of one of their members, and then that woman got reelected again, and now is trying to get them to change the charter, and they refuse. And my point was, there was a great article in the News in Advance, which I thought covered it, but I thought people should listen to the whole thing, so I tweeted out the whole thing. I don't know if anybody's taken me up on that. But I think that just when people can realize just how our government works and how it's made up of people, and those people have to work together one way or the other. So I think sometimes being able to lead people to primary sources so they can realize that, you know, just go right to the source.
Journalist Sean Tubbs with us this morning talking about his brand new podcast series, The Quarantine Report. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Talk about for a few minutes what you've heard and what you've broadcast. Talk a little bit about what the closure of local government means, the services in local government, and what does that mean to local residents.
Well, sure. I can mostly. Well, obviously, both local governments in Charlottesville and Albemarle, and of course throughout our region, there are differing levels. I just mentioned Amherst County to our south, which is out of our region, but they've just opened up their local government offices again. So there's a sense in our community, so far, both Albemarle County and Charlottesville are closed to essential services, meaning you can't just go there. Some things you can do by appointment. So the services of things like registering to vote, you're encouraged to do that all absentee. I'm not sure quite how that works, but in general, things are still on pause in terms of services, but of course you still got to pay bills. Speaking personally, I have gotten a large item pickup through the thing. But where I can mostly speak professionally is about the meetings. Albemarle County, so everybody is operating under a continuity of government ordinance. And this manifests itself in different ways, or mostly through interpretation. In Albemarle County, they have been holding more and more complex meetings because they've sort of been practicing at it for longer. The city of Charlottesville hasn't done that. They, until very recently, I think that they might have had one already. Only city council has met, as well as the public housing board of directors. Those are both, you know, but the real thing at the moment is that all of these meetings are now being held electronically, which really changes the dynamic for governance. And this is something that's fascinating to study. And I'd love to really dig into this. According to, I mentioned a woman named Emily Kilroy earlier. She's the county's communications director. She's has told the board of supervisors that more people are watching these meetings than before. You know, in Albemarle County and Charlottesville, these meetings are made open to the public. The question is, though, I would say, is that how many people do we have that really understand what's happening in a way that can be, that can lead to reporting that, that allows the public to understand? And, you know, I mentioned the Daily Progress folks earlier, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention that they're all having to go on furlough, which means that various eyes are being taken off of all of this public information. So it's really as good as you have people who are willing to look and access and try to make sense of all this stuff. I mean, that's what transparency is. It takes people willing to look.
Sure. And so do you think that this pandemic and this move toward online governance in some ways, do you think that will increase the participation of the average citizen, or will it decrease it, or is it your take on it, or it won't make any change at all?
I think it depends. I mean, from my perspective, and this is just a personal one, I think that all depends on how we can get more eyes on this stuff and to make people realize that local government is how the decisions get made at this level. And if we can figure out a way to work together better, that's going to take shared information and shared goals. And which gets back to the question, which I think was actually, what was the question again? I will admit failure when I know I'm going off course.
No, I was asking about the effect on the participation of people in a democracy. How has it changed by electronic media?
Well, in some ways, I mean, I'm going to argue the good case, which is that if I don't have to go and trudge to another meeting and be around people, I mean, heck, even pre-COVID-19, a lot of people don't want to go to these meetings. But if you can watch from your home, it means and add meaningful dialogue, it's good. So, for instance, there's a lot of obscure meetings that I bet most people don't understand what they are because they don't get covered. Groups like the Natural Heritage Committee, which is an advisory body in Albemarle that advises the Board of Supervisors and staff on biodiversity issues. No one pays attention to that. And so it happens, and it's all public record. Other ones are things like the Solid Waste Alternatives Advisory Committee. There are people who are all over our community who have been trying to solve problems for ages. It's my hope that we can get more people to sort of say, gosh, we really do have to take better care of ourselves as a community. And that's going to take more people paying attention to the nuts and bolts of how things work, you know, and sort of to try to just like, I mean, I'm kind of weird. I think that my bias is towards boredom, or rather what other people would see as boring, I just see as part of a bigger system. A system that I've been in a pretty privileged place to be in these last several years. But, you know, it's weird because, you know, the privilege of going to government meetings. But right now, everybody has access to that privilege. All it takes is timing and a computer screen and a willingness to just sit and learn. And that excites me because I think we can do better that way. But it does take connecting all of it together and being able to paint a bigger picture of what all these local decisions mean and what kind of a system. And for me, that takes journalism.
And Sean, do you think that, are you getting any feedback from from local government, or you heard anything from local government that would suggest that some of these changes, like online access to meetings and that sort of thing, will survive the pandemic and become a legacy of it?
I think it's too early to tell, but I do know that for some of these more, not necessarily the city council or the board of supervisors, but for some of your lower groups that are advisory groups, as long as they're public meetings, so in other words, as long as you can access them, I hope that they do have some, you know, I think that there's a time for experimentation. You know, there's a lot of work right now about innovation. And if you look all across and see the restaurants, for instance, that have pivoted very quickly to innovation, you know, local government can do the same. I think that it's difficult, though, because they have the very real business of putting together a lot of this stuff during a pandemic. Keep in mind that the budgets, the local fiscal picture doesn't necessarily look very rosy at the moment. So, but I think it's just to go back and to try to close that up a little. It's like, you know, it's a question to ask, what is government? Like, how does it work? What is it for? Who benefits from all of the things of government? Well, the answers to those questions depends on people getting in and understanding, again, what the nuts and bolts are.
Sure.
And I think that the more access that can be done and context that can be done. So I guess just to sum it up, I'm able to cover a heck of a lot more meetings more efficiently from home. I'm able to cover, to record two or three things at once, which is for me, that's a plus. Now, the question is, do I have time to go through it all? Because there's a lot of it. So I think things like the quarantine report is a first shot for me to try to figure out a way to tell that story a little bit different and to innovate a little bit myself.
Just a minute or so before our next break, Sean, you've talked in the quarantine report a lot about the importance of testing. What's your take on what's going on with testing here in Charlottesville and Albemarle County?
Sure. Well, it's constantly evolving, and the story since the beginning really has been one of figuring out what this all means as it's going. The response and coordination from the federal level just certainly hasn't been there. We don't need to get into that on this program. So, but, you know, from the early days covering the governor's briefings, covering the briefings that our health district director, her name is Dr. Denise Bonds, has been giving to city council and to the board of supervisors. I mean, they've been very clear from the beginning that testing was an issue. They're, you know, to this point though, where we're in a time now where they, where the testing capacity is there, they're able to, this past week, for instance, there's been, they've been increasing the number of community tests. This is where anybody who wants to can show up and get a test that you know, that's all coordinated. For a lot of it, I think it is this. It's that, you know, again, I asked earlier, what is government? Well, government is the one that has to figure out these situations. And sometimes we as citizens have to just kind of like understand that we're not the experts either. We have to watch and trust the experts, but we have to document them and just track the story. And I feel really good that if you listen to the Charlottesville quarantine report from the beginning to the end, well, we're not at the end yet. You'll see that story has been told there.
Journalist Sean Tubbs with us this morning, talking about his brand new podcast series, The Quarantine Report. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call at 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Stream us live online at 947wpvc.org or on your mobile device via TuneIn. After the break, more with journalist Sean Tubbs. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Please stay with us. We're back with journalist Sean Tubbs, and we're talking about his new podcast series, The Quarantine Report, available on the internet through his site, and also a radio version of it heard right here on 94.7 WPVC at 10 a.m. on Sundays. In fact, just before this program you're listening to right now. Sean, I wanted to talk a little bit about the financial situation. Many people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County are struggling financially. What's your take on, or what are you hearing about the financial hardships that local people are struggling with right now?
Well, here I do know that there has been tremendous community support for all sorts of efforts. It's closed up now. They're not taking any more new customers or patrons or whatever the noun is there. But the Charlottesville Area Community Foundation did raise and other partners something like $3.4 million, I think the figure is. And this is going to folks who can't make their rent, still need help with food. I do know that both the city school system and the Albemarle County school system have continued to provide meals to their students. These are mostly through drop-off situations. On this past Memorial Day, schools weren't open, obviously. Well, they haven't been open, but they really weren't open. And Cultivate Charlottesville, which is a new nonprofit, they got together to help to do that. I think the biggest thing is that there's a lot of people who are just out of work. If you think of restaurant servers, this being a big foodie town, those are folks who are currently not working. Now, some of them might be in limited capacities at the restaurants that have pivoted to takeout. But obviously, there's just a lot of concern. So I think that you see different hits at different sides, obviously. But if you think about the impact of the wineries, there's just a lot. But I think that we don't necessarily know what the impact has been completely yet, and we don't know what it's going to be. There have been these unemployment, the supplemental unemployment payments. One of the things to watch this summer is how that works itself out, especially if we don't get reopened all the way. I guess with everything, we just don't know. And I think that sometimes it's okay not to know.
One thing that seems to get overlooked, but was very fortunately not overlooked by you in your series, is the effect on mental health for people who are quarantined or who are quarantined and who are struggling financially. I'm wondering what's your take? What are you hearing from local officials on the issue of mental health during this pandemic?
I think it's paramount. I have not been able to spend too much time on that topic myself on the program, but every Governor Northam talks about it frequently. And in a recent show, I think the show that aired last Sunday had a statistic, suicides are up. I think that's a troubling statistic. You don't see a lot of coverage of that necessarily, because it's one of those things where, it's maybe something we don't necessarily should talk about in terms of the numbers, because each person is a human being. And I think that's is one of those issues that I think we need to think about more often. I mean, each of us is a human being. This pandemic just brings it out even more, but we already have been in an opioid crisis. There's a lot of people who don't feel connected to each other. So this kind of reveals a lot of what's already there. One of the saddest things I think about all of this is that we might not necessarily see good reporting or good or accurate reporting or numbers on domestic violence, because with schools not being in session, you have a whole set of connections that aren't being made. So, I think it's a big impact. Going back to the last question, there's a lot of stuff we don't know. But what we do know is that some of us, and I'll just out myself here, but some of us who have been in therapy for a long time kind of are prepared maybe to sort of encourage others to look. It's like, I don't know, it's like, be kind to each other at this point. Like I know that's it's very important. I think just, it's like, what are we going to be like when we're through this, and how can we get back? Sorry. But the mental health issue is important to me. I'll just say that I'm doing this podcast for my mental health. I'll just, doing this work is important for me. I know that was a long-winded answer, but I do think that's something I could talk about all the time.
You mentioned in one of your reports recently the difference between social distancing and physical distancing. Could you just talk about that briefly?
Sure. Well, this is something that Dr. Denise Bonds, who's the director of the Thomas Jefferson Health District, has sort of been saying from the beginning. It's this idea that the phrase physical distancing is probably more accurate, because socially, there are some who would argue that we're better connected than we have been before, because as you say, the technology is there in place to allow these video calls. that really is the 21st century come to life, you know, in ways I don't think we quite expected. But, you know, we change when something like this happens. But the word physical distancing, you know, implies that, look, there are reasons, and I prefer the usage of the term physical distancing. I don't necessarily know if everybody understands that, but the social distancing isn't really necessarily accurate, because I think that it implies that we're supposed to stay separate from each other mentally, whereas physical distancing really hits home the idea, though, that like that physical separation is important at this time in order to stop community spread.
Journalist Sean Tubbs with us this morning talking about his brand new podcast series, The Quarantine Report. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Sean, you talked a little bit about in one of your episodes about the effect on public housing. What are you hearing about the issue of public housing in this pandemic era?
Well, it's interesting because this was a piece I did have on recently. The Charlottesville Redevelopment and Housing Authority is the agency that is responsible for the stock of public housing in Charlottesville. Something that's about 376 units or so. Obviously, one of the concerns has been, are people, the demographics are, I don't know the exact, I don't have a printout of the demographics, but there's lots of people of color there, obviously low income, and people who are probably already immunocompromised, especially at places like Crescent Halls. Crescent Halls is on Monticello Avenue. It's that multi-rise building down there. So one of the concerns was, well, how do we get information to people about what to do? Is there enough food? But, you know, it's been an important enough resource an important enough priority. There was a testing event there. I think one of the first, one of the very first massive testing events was done at Crescent Halls, which is a sign of just how much this response, I think, has been trying to respond to the needs of everybody. In terms of public housing itself, those are still stories that I'd like to know. There are other public housing stories that have been sort of obscured in the sense that this is actually we're actually at a time for the first time in a new generation that new public housing units are actually being built downtown. And the pandemic really hit at a time when that story sort of got obscured. That's just an example of how this pandemic isn't really everything telling the story, because those units I think are still under construction. Well, now I have to know. Now I'm going to have to track that down. Thanks, Dan.
Sorry about that, Sean.
That's okay. My job.
I want to segue into talking about the food supply for a couple of minutes. You reported that the poultry plants in the state of Virginia were being closed or were thinking about being closed. Now, I've kind of lost track of that story. Where are we right now on issues with the food supply chain?
Well, the food supply chain, I can speak closer to the items here, closer to us. But I can say that closer to us, of course, are a lot of poultry factories, processing factories over in the Shenandoah Valley near Harrisonburg. I believe that those so far did not demonstrate the same number of outbreaks as on the Eastern Shore in Accomack County, where there are several other facilities. I think it's one of those things where, you know, we both need more reporters, but we also need to know, to have digest of what's happening. So that's something that I think is worth checking in on. Locally, I think it's important to say that, you know, this is an area that has prided itself on its local food movement for, you know, it sort of has been what has made a lot of restaurants. But that's information that's really interesting. I mean, over the last 30, 40, 50 years, our supply chains in America for how we get our food have sort of become global and national rather than local and regional. So it's been interesting to see how groups like the local food hub, for instance, ones that have already been trying to make the link between local food and local consumers, they've pivoted towards doing these drive-through markets. they have increased the amount for a program that they have that goes to low-income families called Fresh Pharmacy. Now, the reason that they sort of had to do that is because a lot of farmers lost their markets very early on. When schools closed, when institutions closed, when the restaurants closed. So, I think that, again, to go back to the theme of journalism, like, this is stuff that I want people to know. It affects them. And I think that we're in a position to relook at everything again, should we choose to. And I choose to. So this is the work that I want to do, is just trying to talk about things that we might have taken for granted, such as food, and such as where it comes from. There's so many great stories from so many great farmers out there.
No real discussion of what's going on in Charlottesville and Albemarle County is complete without a mention of the University of Virginia. The University of Virginia, of course, as everyone knows, brings in millions of dollars of money into the community. There's been hints that they might not open in the fall for student admissions. I'm wondering if you're up on what the current situation is over there at the on the academic side of the University of Virginia.
So far, the university has been clear to speak to the line that essentially that there's a committee that's working on it, and they're going to make a decision sometime in June. You hear a lot of people who do say that they think they know which way the committee is going to go. And honestly, I don't. It's one of those things where I don't know what's going to happen necessarily, but I think it's important to look ahead at what it means if the University of Virginia doesn't meet. But they have not made a decision because we can chart where we want to go if we know what's going to hit us. And that's probably going to mean more restaurants shutting down. But then we have to figure out, well, is it safe? I mean, for me, the question is that, well, we just don't know, right? So what will the information be on the day that they make that decision? And how can we be prepared for it one way or the other? I mean, I think that it's important to have plans. It's important to have contingencies. And watching the local budget cycle come and go this year with amended budgets that had to be made, these are things that you want to make sure that you have a local government that can be responsive to this stuff. And as citizens, we need day-to-day information about what's going on so that we can be informed, so that when the bad news hits, we know what to do. And I think we've seen a lot of that over the last few months. And of course, but the other thing about the University of Virginia is that, this is a place where it's a university that has been part. And from my studio, I should just say, I look out at the medical center every day. And of course, that sort of helped motivate the podcast. I can literally see the hospital right in front of me.
Sure.
But over there is research that has been going on. I mean, one reason that testing capacity was able to be increased in Virginia is because they made a breakthrough and that allowed the test results to come back that much faster. That's part of the story. And I think that we need to remember that we're part of that community too. And they're going to get hit financially in ways that we don't know, that maybe some things don't happen. Does football come back? Does football ever come back? I mean, like, it's just there's just a lot of questions, and we don't know the answers to them. But, one day at a time.
Sean, we're in phase one of the government's of Governor Northam's three-phase program. Can you just quickly cover what's in phase one, phase two, and phase three from a kind of a bird's eye view?
Sure. Well, so we're in phase one, or at least, here's how it worked at least. So phase one was to be met when certain criteria were met. And one of them was a total testing capacity of 10,000 tests a day. Other ones were, an availability the supply of PPE, in other words, that the supply chains were getting to hospitals, not just hospitals, but all throughout the medical system. But phase one is essentially, gradual opening. You can open up a restaurant if you're outdoors at only 50% of your capacity. Stores, non-essential stores could open up, et cetera, et cetera. But, it's just weird because when I drive, I'm not going to mention the name of it, but I went to one major retailer very early, and it was like it's almost like nobody was paying attention to it. It was just very strange, but that's not the time for this. But The other phases, we don't quite know.
Staying at home, even though they could go out, they were choosing not to? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, no, the store was packed. I mean, it was packed with people who were just completely and utterly not, like, it's weird. When you actually go out in the world and see people who don't recognize this, it's just a very jarring thing. And it kind of goes back to those protests. It's like, there are people who are just... They can't open their mind that this is even a possibility.
Right.
And the dire effects of not treating it real outweigh everything else. I mean, again, this is about human lives. It goes back to the question about mental health earlier. You know, it's like we're all human, and yet our politics kind of makes a lot of us expendatory. No, that's not the word. What's the word I'm looking for here, Dan?
Expendable.
Thank you. That's the word. Sorry, I was scarred by that movie of the same title, The Expendables. But so many of us are expendable, or at least it seems that way. And I think that's, you know, we have an opportunity to understand. I mean, I don't know. But going back to the phases, there really hasn't been a lot of information about the specifics of phase two. I think we're really waiting to see if the numbers continue to spike, or if they continue, or just whichever direction they go in. You know, one day at a time, the numbers come in and decisions are made. And, you know, I think that's why it's so important, even though so many people are fatigued about all of this stuff. This is the biggest story of our lifetimes. And I think that we owe it to ourselves and to our families and to our future economy to get this right as we go forward.
Sean, we are out of time, unfortunately. I wanted to, first of all, thank you for stopping by. And, well, you didn't stop by. You stopped by electronically, but you still are at home. If someone wants to, I want to talk about this in two phases, two groups. You have the podcast series, which is where? How do I get to your podcast series?
You know, I still don't really have a good way to describe that. I put this thing together so fast that I never really thought about a good URL or anything. But you can, the best thing to do is to follow me on Twitter at Sean Tubbs, S-E-A-N-T-U-B-B-S on Twitter, as I promote it pretty heavily there. But the other thing is if you just Google Charlottesville Quarantine Report and Simplecast, that should show up. I still, you know, this is not a full-time job for me. It's just something I'm doing in the spare time. So there's a lot of tweaking I still need to figure out. But it's been a real pleasure to be able to experiment. And that includes being able to listen to it or to produce it for this radio station.
Journalist Sean Tubbs with us this morning talking about his brand new podcast series, The Quarantine Report. This and every episode of The Wake Up Call is available on demand at cvillepodcasts.com. Join us next Sunday at 11 a.m. when Rick Moore returns to the anchor chair with another interesting guest. And coming up at noon on 94.7 WPBC, it's El Club del Sabor. For The Wake Up Call, I'm Dan Gould. Thanks for listening. This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPBC LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Engineering assistance was by Mike Friend. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on WPBC LP Charlottesville.